Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to After Dark. I'm Maddie.
And I'm Anthony.
We are heading into the undergrowth, the mountainous regions of the world, in search of Bigfoot.
How come undergrowth is such a weird word? Undergrowth. Sorry,
Anthony's resistant to this already. Take us into the story that you're going to tell.
Guys, it's 1967, and Roger Patterson was a young man living in Washington State looking for something to do. He remembered the odd reports in newspapers about giant footprints in the forests, and he thought, I'm going to find this thing. This could be my ticket out. So, Roger Patterson and his friend Bob Gimlin got a couple of horses and a pickup truck, as you do. They drove the pickup as far as they could into the forest, loaded up the horses and carried on deeper into the wild. At some point, they were riding along beside a creek with a rocky, sandy beach on either side. As they went round a bend, their horses started going crazy. When they looked across at the other side of the creek, they could see why. There's this big, fat, hairy ape thing, and it's looking at them. The horses rear up, and Patterson almost falls, but he gets hold of himself and grabs his camera. As he hits the ground, he's recording, running towards the thing with the camera whirring. He creates what is known as the Patterson-Gimlin film. It's shaky, but you can see this thing look up and see Patterson running towards it, and turn away, rather casually, towards the woods. Except for a moment, when it turns to look back, you get this money shot. You'll know it even without knowing that you know it. Bigfoot looking over its shoulder at the camera as it disappears into the trees.
Version of Bigfoot we all know and love. Now, here to help us track down Bigfoot is an amazing guest today. We have Dan Schreiber. He is a QI elf, he's an author, he's a fact finder, and he's one quarter of the globally successful podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish. When he's not delivering his four favourite facts from the last 7 days, I've always wanted to say that, you can find him fronting The Cryptid Factor and now a new show called We Can Be Weirdos, where he discusses everything, I think it's fair to say, from cursed mummies to eBay disasters. Dan, is that a fair summary?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, nothing's off limits.
Nothing's
off
limits.
Weirdness is everywhere.
Yeah, and one thing that I love that you do on your show, which I think is very much fitting with the episodes that we're going to do on Bigfoot, is your batshit list, where you get people to select things that they might believe in or that they have superstitions about, and then you kind of go through those. And I feel like that's very much the energy that we're going to need to bring to the Bigfoot story today.
Sorry. Batshit list is very much, when we were talking about doing these episodes, I was like, okay, so technically, you know, we're a dark history podcast and we look at myths. And I was like, Bigfoot, okay, sure, let's do an episode on Bigfoot. And then they were like, no, actually, we think we should do three episodes on Bigfoot. And I was like, hold on, three episodes on Bigfoot? I don't understand.
There's been, let's say, heated debate, listener.
No, not very heated, just like, I've been like,
wait, are you skeptic? Am I on a skeptic show? I'm out of here, guys.
Constantly the skeptic in these things. But like, I don't know. For me, it's like, it brings me to this place where I find that history goes a little bit, if that makes sense. Uh-huh. Where I'm a little bit like, what am I talking about here? What actually is this grounded in? So we can talk about it as historians. You're far better on this than I am.
Look, I disagree. And I will say up front, I do not believe in Bigfoot. However,
that's not what she said off air.
It's my my bedroom at home, just Bigfoot pictures everywhere. I've got a costume
Mats
in the corner.
Yeah, totally.
No, for me, it's a history of the 20th century in particular. It's a history of colonialism. It's a history of technology. You know, we're dealing with like video cameras, photographs. It's a history of investigation. It's a history of science and pseudoscience. It's so many things. I think we have to give it the benefit of the doubt.
I think that's right. It's sort of the angle that you approach looking at it from. If you decide, oh, it's so annoying that something that clearly doesn't exist is constantly fed into the media and people are making announcements and so on. Yeah, of course, it's really dull. But if you look at it from the angle of how has it made progression for the rest of the world in technology, as you say, Maddie, all that sort of stuff, it's fascinating. Like if you look at Loch Ness, a lot of stuff that's used for submarines now, like deep sea radar and stuff like that, were invented by people who were trying to invent it to look for the Loch Ness monster. You know, it's these unintended consequences of their search that has kind of spilled over into the world of usefulness,
yes,
I would say.
Or legitimacy or whatever.
There's not enough to justify it, but there are some that if you're in a quick podcast, you can make it sound more impressive than it is.
I didn't know that about the Loch Ness Monster. And you know, people always say that it's war that advances technology and stuff, but actually it's the hunt for cryptids.
It's all the hunt for cryptids. Everything.
Driving world.
Convince me, guys.
Well, like one good example, just like to sort of set the tone of why these things can lead to progress. This is a very different thing, but the EEG machine, I learned this recently from Richard Wiseman. So we obviously use that all the time for brain scans and all that. It's so important in medicine today. So that was invented by a guy called Hans Berger, who was out when he was a young soldier. He was riding on a horse and he fell off the horse. And these other, a horse and a cannon, I think it was, were coming behind him. And he thought, I'm dead. It's literally behind me. I'm going to get trampled. So he braced for death, knew it was coming. And then there was a silence and he looked up and somehow they'd stopped the horse and he'd survived. So he was like, wow, I should have died. That's insane. Goes back to wherever he's staying and a telegram arrives for him later that day. And it's from his dad. His dad says, hey, just sending a message over because your sister insisted I do. She had the weirdest feeling this afternoon that you were in serious trouble and you might be, you know, in danger of death. Just checking in, you're okay. And he thought, was my feeling of death so strong that my sister felt it? Did I somehow telepathically get that across to her? So he thought maybe there's something in telepathy. And he spent the rest of his life, well, a large portion of his life, trying to invent a machine that could find telepathy, and accidentally invented the EEG machine as a result of it. So we have that thanks to the search for telepathy.
So that
kind of stuff, it's sort of, you know, when you look at it through those lenses, you sort of realize that weirdness can be useful.
However,
yeah,
that is fascinating, truly. I think when we talk about Bigfoot, though, or this Bigfoot type monster, I also see it as a form of almost deliberate charlatanism, as in I am deliberately going to try and deceive you with fake proof, as opposed to what you just described, which is actually this genuine hunt for knowledge and for discovery. In this instance, now I think that does exist with Bigfoot too. I don't think that's
there
the
are different
altogether.
Factors.
Right,
though, so much hoaxing,
But the hoax element, it feels like people are trying to shortchange us all the time or something, and repeatedly over and over and over again. And these sightings, for me, are a symptom of that.
I completely agree with that. And I think there are people out there who deliberately do it. It's a fun project. You know, we'll get on to Gimlin and Patterson in a sec, but that, you know, arguably was a homemade video. There's a big argument for that, in that I don't think Bigfoot exists.
That it is.
But the thing that fascinates me again is it's what we find so interesting by looking at history. And we love grouping together the belief systems of people at the time and logging it and seeing how it progressed. And I sometimes find it interesting that we get so bored of our own belief systems, because there are thousands, if not millions, of people around the world who maybe do believe in things like ghosts or Bigfoot, and they are living a different existence to the three of us in this room, because their belief system fits that in to the world that they live in, right? So you get these facts. I put them in, I always call them facts with inverted quotes. Inverted quotes, what are they called?
Commas. Commas.
Inverted commas.
Inverted commas.
Sure.
Fingers.
There's no education here, that's fine.
Bunny rabbits, two of them, either side of the sentence.
Not one of the three of us could come up with what that is. That's fine.
But, you know, the big moment for me that I became really interested in this world was when I discovered a fact about Bigfoot, and it was
nothing to do with what I thought was a thing based in truth. I thought someone was just taking the piss. I was talking to Brian Blessed, who...
As one does.
As one does. We might talk about him later. But he really believes in Bigfoot. And
He does. He does
legit,
believe
legit. Like, he right. and I were going to go off looking for Bigfoot. We'd planned a whole expedition.
I would watch that documentary.
Oh, we were going to go to...
So you're filming this, right? Because we're watching that, regardless of what I think about Bigfoot.
Is the twist that Brian Blessed is Bigfoot? Yeah.
Well, he's often been mistaken for it. And that's an interesting point as well. Wow. Is that a lot of what is thought to be Bigfoot is actually people
it's
and
Brian
yes,
Blessed.
He's Brian Blessed on all his global adventures.
There's the famous quote from David Attenborough as well, isn't there, where he talks about the other side of the theory, going back to the sort of the science side of things, where he talks about there may be a giant ape that we have yet to discover in some of the most remote parts of the world, including the Himalayas. That
yeah.
there's this sense that these animals might be so advanced that they see us and they hear us coming and they are able to hide and retreat into
I'm saying no, sorry.
That's why
I don't mean to go against Sir David.
These are Sir David's words.
National treasure. But no, come on.
Not just Sir David. Brian Blessed himself agrees with that opinion. He says that they can smell our aggression. So when he's looking for Bigfoot, he likes to whistle and skip and sing songs with flowers in his hair.
Please make this documentary.
But so he's the one who told me that when you're being pursued by Bigfoot or possibly a Yeti, that it's easier to escape the female ones if you're running downhill, because the females have such long dangling boobs that before they can chase you, they need to put them over their shoulders, tie them up like a scarf so they don't trip on them. And in the time it takes them to do that, you can make your escape.
Is this Brian's theory?
This is Brian's theory. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. So then I met a Bigfoot and a Yeti believer. And I said, I heard the funniest thing the other day about if you're running away. And they went, yeah, the boobs, tying them up. Yeah,
stop.
True. Yeah. And this, and then every single Bigfoot book that I've read, that is in there. It is a classic fact with the bunny rabbits on either side of the sentence.
Wow.
That is a thing. And I've been telling that fact for I think something like 10 years. It was only the other day that I discovered that it's easier. This is one of the greatest joys of my life, was discovering this extra bit of fact.
Oh,
it is easier to escape a male Yeti if you're running uphill, because they have such long dangling testicles that they smack along the rocks as they're going up the hill. And that is taught to people in Bhutan, where they believe in the Yeti and they have a massive national park to protect the Yeti. Dasho Benji, I believe his name was.
Yeah, they're legally protected.
Yeah, they're a legally protected animal. They have a big park. There used to be a royal Yeti / Bigfoot hunter for the king.
Yeah.
He also doubled as the basketball coach to the king.
No, that's good. He needs to do something with his time.
Exactly.
No more questions.
Yeah. And that's what they would tell you. If you're pursued, if it's a woman, run down.
Downhill.
If it's a man... run up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pendulous Bigfoot running, like roaming the hillside.
I think we can end it there. I think we've said all we can possibly say. Wow. Let's go into some of these sightings, though, because people really do believe, you know, we're talking about these kind of slightly mad seeming theories, but actually people present footage and photographs and evidence, physical objects, as real proof that these exist.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Patterson-Gimlin footage. It's from, I think, 1967, Anthony said at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's the Bigfoot image that we all know, even if you've only seen the still rather than the whole, I think it's only a few minutes of footage, isn't it? But tell us about that, Dan.
Yeah, so as you already mentioned, these were two guys that were going out on the day to make a film of a Bigfoot, because they were in the world of entertainment. Gimlin, amazing character. He's still alive. He's the one who kind of does all of the tours now. So he'll go and show the video and get signed photos and all that sort of stuff. He used to be like a stunt driver. So he used to go on what were effectively like wooden chariots around the canyons and go nearly off the edge. Like he was a total badass in what he did. And so, yeah, so they're out there one day and they're looking for, maybe they're looking for it or they're planning to make a film. They capture this footage and it's become the bedrock of this whole belief system ever since. I mean, the analysis that has happened on this film, where new footage has come, or new techniques, as you said, where it's kind of like, it used to be a very shaky film. Now they've made it still. You can get better high def AI is being used to sort of like bring up the images a bit more. And I've seen arguments that each time it's like academic warfare, where someone's trying to disprove it and someone's trying to prove it, and they keep drilling into a newer detail. The one I saw, it was like 10 years ago, but it was one of my favorites. It was that the argument came down to the movement of the anal gland of the Bigfoot and whether or not, you know, they're going, you can't get a suit that has that kind of anus. They don't make anuses that detailed.
Little do they know.
Why is all the taxonomic detail of these animals so undignified?
But my favorite detail, which I learned from James Harkin, who's on my fish podcast, I think this is honestly the best fact I might have ever learned. It's that when it got big, basically it's the 60s, right? So they're going town to town showing this footage and sort of trying to turn it into a thing. Gimlin, who is now the person who will sign photos of it and stuff, didn't like it. He didn't like what was going on, and he went back to work on his ranch with his horses and stuff. But Patterson went out on tour with it, and he realized that people were there to see Gimlin and Patterson. So he brought in someone else to play Gimlin.
Oh my gosh.
So isn't that wonderful? While everyone was trying to look at the footage and work out if that was real or not, there was a fake Gimlin.
Wow. But here's the thing. So we know they fake. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So we know that they are not beyond a performance. We know that the commercial aspect.
And they have a history in the entertainment industry.
And so the blueprint here for them selling this story or this account, indefinitely we know for a fact, as you've just said, involves a forgery of, you know, of an identity. So therefore, and Gimlin today would say, I guess, that this is genuine footage, that this was what they
captured. He's never backed down on the footage. I mean, I think that's an interesting side to it. Gimlin didn't profit from it for a long, long time. Mm. He stayed away from it. He has no interest in it. I don't know what kind of money he makes from it now. Sure. Like, sure, he's making money off selling photos. It can't be that much. Yeah. It's only me and a few others buying photos and constantly on eBay trying to track down.
Yeah, it's a tricky... I don't know. I don't know why it sits so uncomfortably with me, because who cares?
Well, no, you're right. It's hoaxing people. It's making them dedicate their lives to something that there's no solid basis. And they're being tricked. People are being conned, if that's the case, of what's going on. I think most likely that's what's happening here. Mm. I enjoy not calling them out for it, though. Like, personally, I think I look at history and I look at all the wonderful mythologies and things that people believed in. I sort of go with Bigfoot. What is the ultimate damage that this belief is causing?
Absolutely.
Is it a lot? Maybe it is a lot to some people. Yeah. Not in the same way as, say, like psychics and mediums, where they tell you that your child is, you know, like that's had a lot of problems in the past and currently. But I can't see the I'm sure one of your listeners will say it is hugely problematic. There are things. But to me, it's enjoying fireside stories as a kid, as an adult, for a lot of people. Mm. And is that a bad thing? I don't know.
In all of the prep for this and all of the chat that we have had, and Dan, you just said something, I think maybe even mistakenly, you said something about it being related to childhood.
Yeah.
And suddenly it made sense to me. In that moment, I was like, there's a nostalgia to this, to returning to something you potentially did believe as a child, or the stories that you're, you know, the fireside stories that you're referencing. And actually, there's a comfort in Bigfoot, bizarrely, despite this kind of monstrous appearance.
I don't know. I think it depends. I think it depends on the historical context. Thank you very much. We are a history podcast. Yes, it must stem from childhood, this sense of wanting the world to be different from how you perceive it, the reality around you, and feeling that there's something else, that there's something magical that you just can't see that's working behind the scenes. But if you think about, you know, in 1967... in America, in Washington, where this footage is shot, think about the context of that. There's huge social change. There's the civil rights movement. There's the space race. We've talked on episodes before about alien encounters in the 60s, and this idea of the Cold War, I suppose, and sort of fear of the other, fear of people coming in, fear from the sky, fear that there are spies in your landscape, in your community, and that everything is a danger to you in some way. I think Bigfoot, in this context, actually... It is fun, but it is also maybe a manifestation of some of that anxiety as well. Actually.
Or an escape from it. As in, like, I know all of this is happening and it's horrendous. Mm-hmm. Let's look at this big hairy thing.
Mm. Yes.
I don't know why I'm pointing to you.
Mm. I am quite hairy, so it does make sense, yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, it gives you... And therefore, there's the comfort coming in again.
Mm, yeah.
I'm not saying it's one right or wrong way to look at it. It's just sometimes I need to remember to have fun, I think.
Yeah,
rather
I
than
think
constantly
so.
Being like, well, actually, I don't get it. But there's another sighting, right? There's another
sighting. There is, yes. So three years after the sighting in Washington and the footage is shot, there is a sighting. This time it's in Japan. Is that right, Dan?
Oh, yeah. So this is a story that I was just researching recently. So 1970.
Okay.
This is when this happened. And it's in a town north of Hiroshima called Saijo. And a man's in a pickup truck, and he claims that he has an encounter with an ape-like creature. And so many locals in the village suddenly all claim that they've been seeing it too. They say it's a 1.6 meter tall animal. It's got a face like an inverted triangle, which is a very interesting face.
Wow.
And it's called Hibagon. And yeah, as soon as word got around, all media sort of came swarming, wanted to learn more about it. People who encountered it, who were mainly adults, said that they would find holes in the ground after it left. It would rip up trees, all that sort of stuff. And this town got really interested in it because of the media and the tourism that was coming in, that they basically announced that they were going to have their own post for an employee to be the official hunter, but also the kind of media relations for for this creature. Because, yeah, there was just so much interest coming in, and all the townsfolk were just being doorstopped by journalists. So it was like, rather than going to the individuals and hassling them, let's have like someone who gets all the stories reported to them, yeah. And then they're able just to like pump them out whenever people come in. So he was in charge of that, and I believe tax services as well, because obviously it's a government job. You can't just focus on Bigfoot.
What they join up with these things, basketball,
taxes,
Bigfoot.
Okay. Yeah.
So basically, for a long time, this was a job that you could be the official Bigfoot town PR, basically representing the stories of the people that were coming in, and then slowly, like all these things, they gradually died down in interest, and that's what happened there. But for a while, Japan had a sort of lesser known Bigfoot, and obviously being just a bit north of Hiroshima, only a few decades after the bomb, you know, a lot of stories come out about mutant creations off the back of these things. You know, Loch Ness has a layer of radioactive waste that sits at the bottom of Loch Ness, which was blown over in the winds from Chernobyl. And so there's one thought that what if Loch Ness didn't exist a long time ago, but then existed because the fish have mutated into weird dinosaur-looking monsters. And so I think that's kind of connected with that. I mean, the stories connected with the bomb, like Godzilla and so on, are very representative of how the world created monsters in Japan off the back of their horrible decisions. And so I think even though this is not directly tied in, it can't be separated, I don't think.
Which is what you were saying earlier, right? That it's a reflection
that context
of what's going on.
Yeah, and actually when we've spoken about the Loch Ness monster, we looked at the 1930s sighting. And there's huge anxiety about sort of monstrous things in the build-up to the Second World War and the rise of Nazism. And so it's interesting that it has this context. I think in this situation as well, it's a more positive thing to come out of that area of Japan. And, you know, that is known globally for the atomic bombs, that there's the output is suddenly, okay, it's dealing in this idea of mutation and almost body horror that to come out of it. But it's taking control of that narrative and it's sort of flipping it on its triangle-shaped head. And
inverted triangle.
Yeah, inverted. Yeah.
I mean, I think most of the stories have nothing to do with the bomb. I just think, as you're saying, you can't escape.
Like, you can't separate.
It feels like it. Yeah. In that case, it really does feel like it, I think, that it has to be linked to that idea of monstrosity. And
it's interesting that it crops up in Japan, that we've had it in North America, and of course you have the Yeti associated with the Himalayas. That is it a universal idea across human culture to have a larger than us thing out there? Or are these actually completely different creatures, whether they exist or not, that are cropping up to mean different things for different people? Can we put them all in the same bracket? I don't know.
No, they're not. I mean, they're different species. Like, if you bracketed Yeti as the same as Bigfoot, you'd be wrong. Yeah, very different. And then Australia has the Yowie, and it's the Australian Bigfoot, and it lives out in the deserty bits. And I think they all have different roles. Definitely, I think the Yowie's kind of tied in with Australian culture, with the Aboriginals more so than, say, the Westerners. I think in America, Bigfoot is just like this mysterious dude walking around that various people are trying to hunt all the time. Mm. All the stories that come out, and they come out weekly, and it's this kind of thing of like, are they telling the truth, or are they absolutely just hoaxing and trying to get a splash in the media for whatever reason? I've read stories of people saying, my horse's hair has been braided overnight. That was Bigfoot. And those are the headlines, like, you know, Bigfoot braids horse hair. My American flag has been eaten by, you know,
Bigfoot.
Who's angry at America. And
So why is it then? Because, again, this is an interesting distinction. Why is it you're talking about the Japanese sightings there and the different legends that are growing up in that area. Why is it then when I hear more about the American one, I go, well, there's your fake.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's something about North American Bigfoot specifically, as opposed to Yeti, that is the harder one for me to swallow.
Well, I think as well, because when you say sort of like Japan or Australian Aboriginal myth, it's almost the equivalent of like analysing old religion versus the new ones that are cropping up. And it's just, there's more for us to pick apart with the new ones because we can see them being formed.
Yeah.
You know, none of all those old ones in Japan and Australia would largely have wood carvings and drawings for the representation. Whereas exactly a video means we can go, oh, hang on a second. Mm. That suddenly you've given us too
we
much
know
evidence.
That. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, you've shown us too much here. And so it suddenly brings out the skeptical side of us. And also, yeah, I think there is just something a bit more pop culture-y about the Bigfoot movement in America than the feeling of it, the way they talk about it. There's all these, like, it's always in the news where you have, like, you know, $50,000 to anyone who can hunt down a Bigfoot, says local mayor,
kind
of thing. Found out this thing ages ago that when they were filming Return of the Jedi in the North Californian forests, when they were doing the Chewbacca scenes, when Chewbacca went out in costume, he had to be surrounded by guys in high-vis jackets.
God.
Yeah,
oh,
because they were worried hunters were going to see him and go, it's Bigfoot, and shoot him. And also that's the scary thing. The culture is kill Bigfoot, whereas everywhere else is a kind of more respectful.
One thing that really interests me, I think, about Bigfoot in particular is it seems to attract characters more than any other cryptid. Let's talk about one of these people, Grover Krantz. Anthony, I think you have a little bit of a story to tell us about this person, and then we're going to get into who he is and what his role with Bigfoot is in the world.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Maddie, if you want to go and see Grover Krantz, anthropologist, cryptozoologist, and Bigfoot expert, then head to the Smithsonian Museum. There you will find his skeleton in a cabinet. It is on display at his insistence in a loving embrace with another set of bones. The skeleton of a gigantic dog and the love of his life, Clyde. Krantz was married several times, but his relationship as a young man with his Irish wolfhound, Clyde, was the closest relationship he ever had. Of course, I like Irish wolfhounds. So when Clyde the dog died, Krantz couldn't bring himself to let go. He decided he wanted to keep Clyde's skeleton, something he knew how to do as a skilled taxidermist. But he couldn't bring himself to cut Clyde open to get out the bones. Oh, so he decided to bury Clyde in the back garden and let Mother Nature do the work. Good man. A year or so later, he came back to dig up Clyde. The sun was going down. He was by himself. The first thing he found was Clyde's skull. Oh no. Grover Krantz sat in the hole in his back garden with his dog's skull in his hand, having a Shakespearean moment. This is all perfectly normal. Why do we do it to ourselves? He asked. Why do we let ourselves fall in love like this when death is sure to come? It was around the same time that he was digging up Clyde in his back garden that Krantz began to believe that these Bigfoot creatures that he had read so much about might be real. Was he substituting Bigfoot for Clyde? Bigfoot would not let him get too close. With Bigfoot, he could keep it at a distance. Perhaps Bigfoot would let him have a deep, meaningful relationship with a large, furry animal,
without tearing his heart to pieces.
That is an interesting story.
That is how I want to be preserved with my two dogs.
Oh, my little dog.
Maybe not in the Smithsonian.
No, somewhere more local, like the NHM. Yeah.
Welcome, Institute.
I do always say about I'd quite like my dogs taxidermied after they've died.
Really?
But yeah, my husband's like, don't do that.
I'm
I will
with
leave.
Matt on this. Yeah, no, Matt, don't let her do that.
Because they sit either side of me when I write at home, and I want them. I feel like I won't be able to write ever again if they're not both there.
Listen,
so I need them.
We are bordering on acceptable creepability already. If you
I'm really
do that.
Outing
myself you are
today.
Going over. I am telling you now. This I'm trying to save your reputation here. Don't get your dog stuffed and put them side by side.
Yeah.
Anyway, who is Grover Krantz? Why is he stuffing his dog? Well, why is he?
Yeah,
getting
and what,
buried
and what does
dog?
That have to do with Bigfoot?
Yeah, so he's a big deal in the cryptozoology world because this was you had all these people, and you know this was in 1969, so it's only a few years after the Gimlin-Patterson thing, where suddenly, like when Ken Arnold reported seeing a flying saucer in 1947, 800, you know, more encounters. Yeah, suddenly people are reporting stuff. And same with Bigfoot. Everyone's coming forward with a story about something that they've seen. But they're all amateur. They're all people who are just, you know, out there living in their houses and so on. And no one's an academic. Grover Krantz comes along. He's the first academic who properly puts his reputation on the line to say, I think these things are real. So he had tenure at Washington State University. Part of his agreement to the tenure was that he would give one Bigfoot lecture a year, which is really nice. And he kind of became a believer when he found a footprint outside a mining town, and that was in 1969. That properly convinced him that Bigfoot was a real thing. And so he spent a lot of his time trying to analyze other future findings, going on little expeditions himself. He's got a really interesting, like, this is a tangent sideline, but one of his wives, you mentioned he had a few wives, one of his wives was the granddaughter of Albert Einstein.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, and I've always dreamed of being at the dinner table between Albert and Grover, a man of rationalism sitting with this Bigfoot believer. But it turned out that Einstein had already passed away, sadly, before got the chance to...
Oh, never going to happen.
Yeah. It's you can go into this in another show one day, but there's a whole theory that the granddaughter came up with that she was actually the daughter of Albert Einstein and from an affair that she had had, and she had proof. And
she did that herself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a wonderfully weird story.
Yes.
She was a Trekkie as well. It's just another detail. so he's an interesting character, Grover Krantz. He's the first person who brings the academia into it. And after that, more and more academics kind of started joining the interest of looking for these things. But of course, you know, the footprint that he found, it wasn't a Bigfoot footprint. They would later find out that there was, you know, reasons behind. I'm not sure it necessarily was an admitted hoax, but it certainly wasn't what we thought it was.
I'm really interested in this issue of legitimacy and sort of validity in terms of scientific investigation and thinking about cryptozoology. Today is considered something of a pseudoscience, but in the 60s and 70s at least, real scientists, real serious scientists were wanting to work in that field, or to at least push the boundaries of it. There was a kind of a blurring of lines between what we would now think of real science and fake science, for maybe want of a better term. And that he sort of sits in the middle of that to a certain extent. Was he interested in this for his whole career? Was this something that he fought for as being real
until
the end of his life?
Yeah, it kind of took over. It was sort of I think once you open that genie's bottle, you're in it. Particularly if people start rallying around you and you get interest in your find. I think it's intoxicating. I think a lot of people fall into that world by accident and then become ambassadors for it. But I think as well in the 60s, you know, you kind of go, well, yeah, why not? Why not there be a Bigfoot out there? Like, there's so much. I flew back to Australia. I'm from Sydney, and I flew back to Australia recently, and it was the first time where I was sitting in a window seat and I was looking out as we were flying over, I think it was Perth. I'm not quite sure, but it was certainly like the coast of Australia inward. And I was looking down, and Australia in your mind is just a huge vacant desert in the middle, and there's a coast that is mainly it. But that coast is actually obviously ginormous, and you're looking at just so much forest as you're flying over. It's so much. And as you fly over, you go, Well, what, have we looked everywhere?
Anything could be in there. Yeah.
This one, has anyone ever been to this one spot that I'm pointing at through the window right now? Because that is so far from anywhere. And why would you go there? And and in America, you have these vast areas in any of these places where people like Jane Goodall, you know, are living, and they get those stories. You go, well, why not? Like,
It could be career defining. It could be reputation. It could be forever your legacy for time immortal. You become slightly immortal by making a discovery if it was there to be discovered. And it's not like people are not in the 60s uncovering new forms of dinosaurs that they didn't know about, new skeletons, new fossils, all of this kind of thing. So there was an understanding, as there should still be today, that we absolutely have not come across every species that's ever inhabited the earth.
And it's interesting, Dan, that you just mentioned Jane Goodall, because she was a believer. She's the ape lady, right?
No, so Jane Goodall's one of the great studiers of primates. And she absolutely, when she does interviews, she's never, I don't think, officially put her sort of finger down on, I don't know what analogy I was reaching for there.
On the hairy foot.
On the hairy foot and said, I believe in it. But she does appear on very weird shows where she says, I am told about tall, big, unidentified people that the locals who spend their entire life in these woods or in these forests, they know everything.
Yeah.
And they're saying, we don't know what that was. So she's going, well, so what is that? And it might be a Bigfoot. And most of these people don't think a Bigfoot is what people think. As I was saying before, Reinhold Messner, who is one of the first people to go, if not the first person to go up Everest without any oxygen, he wrote a whole book about looking for the Yeti. And his whole thing was, well, I think it's probably a bear. I think it's something.
Sure.
And so when we talk about what, you know, Loch Ness monsters and Bigfoot are cryptids, there also, I think, needs to be a bit of an update on the current thinking about it. A good friend of mine, Steve Feltham, who's got the Guinness World Record for the longest continuous search for the Loch Ness Monster. He lives on the banks of Loch Ness in a mobile library home. He's been there, for over 3 decades. Wow. You talk to him and you would think, oh, he thinks it's a plesiosaur. Or he thinks it's... No, he thinks it's an out-of-place animal. He thinks it's a Wells catfish. That's what he thinks it is, you know, or a giant eel, as some people would say. But a lot of people don't think Bigfoot will be this, do we put him in a zoo or the Hilton? Mm-hmm. Like, they don't think it's that animal anymore. They think it's something. That's all it is. It's something. Whereas the American one is where it kind of makes it, no, it's Bigfoot. It's,
He would definitely need a hotel room. And a razor.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I think if there's more than one thing I've learned in this episode, it is that the power of storytelling that I very much stand behind anyway, and actually there is an awful lot to be said for that. So if you put Bigfoot in that context, that for me suddenly has emotional meaning to other people, even if it doesn't to me personally, and so therefore it's important. So that's a progress on my behalf. And the other thing, this idea of it being something, even if we don't quite know what that is, and even if that something is not necessarily real, it shows that there's a shift in mindset, that we're going maybe to, you talked about cryptozoology earlier and occupying this middle ground. And actually, I'm wondering if that middle ground is moving towards different areas at different times in history, depending on what our belief systems are, given that. So this has been a learning day for me, guys. Thank you very much, Dan, for joining us on After Dark. It's been a really interesting conversation, especially one that I went into initially with my arms folded, just going, oh, God, what?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What are we talking about? But actually, there's a lot there. There's a lot to kind of talk about. If you enjoyed this episode, please find all our other back catalogue of After Dark episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and subscribe. It helps other people find the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Well,
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of After Dark. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcast. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour.
Don't forget, you can listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe.
And as a special gift, now don't say we never give you anything, you can also get your first 3 months for £1 a month when you use the code AFTERDARK at checkout.